You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The Washington Post carries the headline, in landmark decision, appeals court finds that federal law bans workplace discrimination against gays. Now, no one's in favor of negative discrimination in the workplace or anyplace else, but it cited and built its case on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Is that a legitimate place to begin legally in order to ban discrimination? We're going to be talking about this decision and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. John Eastman joins us on this Wednesday afternoon, professor of law and community at Chapman University in Orange, California, and chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage. John, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, thanks very much for having me back on.
Is the term sexual orientation, is it found in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act?
No, it's not there. And in fact, for decades, there have been efforts in Congress to amend Title VII to add sexual orientation to the statute, and those efforts have never succeeded. The Title VII bans discrimination in employment on the basis of race, color, religion, and sex, and national origin, but it does not include sexual orientation or family status or veteran status or a lot of other categories that we could add.
Does it matter whether or not the language is actually found in there, given the legal orientation of the appeals court here?
Well, apparently it doesn't matter to the Seventh Circuit, who have a case of statutory interpretation decided yesterday by the full court, an 8-3 vote, over a strong dissent by Judge Diane Sykes, I might point out, that says it doesn't matter. We're going to reinterpret the word sex to include sexual orientation. They unclear whether it will also now include gender identity or anything else. But that means they are acting like legislators, not as judges.
Okay, so explain that, because so many of us have become accustomed to the fact that the judiciary at various levels actually writes or rewrites law rather than simply interprets or applies the law vis-a-vis the Constitution. What's the difference?
I think this is even more egregious than the normal judicial overreach. So normally they're at least looking at language that is somewhat amorphous. Like the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Well, what exactly does that mean? And there's unfortunately a lot of wiggle room that an activist judge can utilize to impose or import his own views into constitutional law. But there's no question that Title VII does not include sexual orientation. There's no question that it didn't, that the meaning of the word sex in 1964 when it was adopted did not extend to sexual orientation or gender identity. There's no question that the statute has not changed. And so the judges are now just changing the law on their own to accomplish something they think ought to be accomplished, even though the legislature has chosen not to do that. And this is a burden. You began with saying, of course, nobody wants to discriminate. Well, any small business employer can decide who he wants to hire. The Title VII restrictions prohibit him from making that judgment in certain areas of the case. That's an infringement on his own freedom of association and liberty. So how far to extend those restrictions is a fundamental matter of legislative policy. And the legislature has included some categories that were historically subject to discrimination, but it has chosen not to include lots of other categories in that ban on discrimination, leaving the private market free to order itself as it wants. And now the judges have taken it upon themselves to change the law.
I want you to deal specifically with some of the argument, or the argument that was made, and this is quoting from the Washington Post piece, Diane Wood, who wrote the Tuesday opinion for the majority of the court, writes this of Kimberly Hively. Hively's claim is no different from the claims brought by women who were rejected for jobs in traditional male workplaces, such as fire departments, construction, and policing. Any discomfort, disapproval, or job decision based upon the fact that the complainant, woman or man, dresses differently, speaks differently, or dates or marries a same-sex partner is a reaction purely and simply based on sex, and that means it falls within Title VII's prohibition against sex discrimination if it affects employment in one of the specified ways. What's the problem with that particular line of reasoning?
Well, it's just not what the statute says. We know what sex means. It means you're preferring a man over a woman or vice versa because they are a man or a woman. That's not what sexual orientation is. And you know, preferring a heterosexual over a lesbian or a gay man is a sexual orientation classification. It's not a gender or a sex classification. And if it is, then the statutory language has no meaning. And like I said earlier, the decades of efforts to amend Title VII to include sexual orientation were just a complete waste of time because, heck, it already did it. Well, that's just nonsense. Nobody understood Title VII to have included sexual orientation claims. Nobody understood it in 1964 or in the 50 years since. So this is judicial activism, just rewriting the law because they think this ought to be the policy rather than what the law actually says.
What is the problem with making sexual orientation a protected class under the law?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people in this country that still think homosexual conduct is immoral, and therefore they don't want to associate with them. And in a private, it's a different for the government to not be able to discriminate than for private actors to not be able to choose their employees as they wish. We don't allow that in certain narrow contexts because of a long-running history of discrimination. But we have to recognize that any such restriction on the ability of an employer to choose his own employees undermines that employer's liberty and freedom of association. So let's add this category by the legislature if we think on balance it should. But let's add veteran status, and let's add familial status, and let's add how many other categories are we going to, and how much of liberty of the employer are we going to truncate? Well, those are fundamental legislative judgments. They're not judicial judgments.
Can this be understood, this decision that was taken on Tuesday, can it be understood outside the context of the 2015 Supreme Court decision, Obergefell?
Well, of course it can. This is a statutory interpretation case, and we know what sex in the statute means. Obergefell was a 14th Amendment equal protection case, and the equal protection clause is, as I said earlier, a very amorphous clause. So reading into that a right of same-sex marriage, which I think was also very illegitimate, is not as a deviation from the clear text that we have here in Title VII.
There are those who would argue, look, all that LGBT persons are seeking is the same gains in terms of civil rights that were gained during the classic civil rights era by African Americans. What is your response?
Well, that may be, but their remedy is to go for the legislature, to have the legislature change the law, not to get some unelected judge change the law for them and impose it on the rest of the country, even though the legislative judgment, and therefore our representatives who are chosen by the citizens of this country, have chosen not to change the law.
So is this a failure of democracy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's very good reason why we haven't over the last half century altered Title VII to include sexual orientation. Title VII itself should be a narrow exception to the general rule that I get to choose who I associate with, and that means I get to choose who I hire to work for my business. We have a narrow exception to that with Title VII, and quite frankly, I think it ought to remain narrow.
So what happens now with this decision? Where does it go from here?
Well, it creates a conflict with a couple of other circuit courts around the country. So I suspect it's headed fairly quickly to the Supreme Court of the United States.
And What do you, realistically, what do you think its prospects are there?
Well, nobody knows what Justice Kennedy would do. Like I said, this is not the amorphous clause of equal protection in the 14th Amendment. This is a fairly straightforward, unambiguous bit of statutory text. And if Justice Kennedy is going to have any last semblance of still being a judge rather than a super legislator for the country, a Praetorian leader for us all, then the Seventh Circuit's decision here ought to be overruled.
If it isn't, and this comes before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, yes, Title VII ought to be read as including sexual orientation, what kind of a door would the High Court have opened then?
Well, you know, Title VII still has a religious liberty exception, a religious employer exception. So there will be probably an attack on that to say you're now infringing on the rights. Since the rights are not statutorily based, then why should the exception be statutorily based either? More fundamentally, and I think Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion in Obergefell recognizes the problem here. Every time the court takes it upon itself to settle policy questions that are not grounded in the law, it moves one step closer to being reminded of its own impotence. And at some point, I think the American people are going to react against the courts just kind of deciding basic policy questions for us, questions that they have no basis under the law to decide.
Is that part of the problem here, though, John, that the average American may simply not realize that the judiciary is overstepping?
Well, I think the more the judiciary oversteps, the more likely the American people are to recognize that. And look, you know, it's no accident that there's a fight going on over Neil Gorsuch, that the President Trump was elected in part because he put out a list of judges, all of whom are devoted to strictly applying the law. And that means the American people are starting to pay attention to this important issue of judicial overreach. Without that issue, President Trump may just be, Trump headquarters CEO Trump and not President Trump. So I think the American people, at least a significant number of voters in the last election, are weighing in, saying this activist judiciary that thinks they can just remold our country in the ways they think appropriate, contrary to the law, that overreach is going to stop. And I think that was part of the platform of the last election.
The narrow case here was a lesbian woman, but it strikes me that sexual orientation now injected into Title VII is a rather fuzzy category in and of itself. Should we expect this to be reinterpreted yet again to include things that are beyond orientation, but things like transgenderism?
Well, of course, because under the same reasoning that Judge Wood gave for this case, the transgender claim would be made if what we mean by sex is not biological sex, but is kind of how one is viewed in accord with normal gender norms, then it's a fair game for every claim. And Title VII would now have been, be a much broader statute than Congress ever envisioned.
Would the courts then, in that case, have fully embraced the kind of new way of thinking about gender and sex as mere social construct?
They would have. That's right. And again, you're now talking about a pretty radical policy change being imposed by a couple of unelected judges without any basis in the law. And I'll remind people what Abraham Lincoln said about this question. If basic policy disputes are to be settled by the courts in ordinary litigation between two private parties, and those decisions be deemed as settling the matter forevermore for all the rest of us, we will have ceased to that extent to be a self-governing people.
Finally, John, you live in California, you work there. Is there something that folks listening in the Midwest and in the South can learn from your state about the advance of the LGBTQ agenda? About 1 minute.
Well, yeah, people forget how, the cost, the threat to family structure, the extraordinary loss of a cultural foundation, a cornerstone of civil society that comes when we do these things that are such a serious threat to basic human biology norms of the family that are at the heart of the family, and the family is the cornerstone of civil society. So it's not a surprise that you see where in states like California, where this agenda is more advanced than elsewhere, that we see real threats and dysfunction creeping in family structures.
John Eastman is professor of law and community at Chapman University in Orange, California, and chairman of the board for the National Organization for Marriage. John, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
On the other side of the break, it's part 11 of our series on Lutheran identity. Today we'll talk about the big time of the Reformation. It's beginning with the presentation of the Augsburg Confession and what it had and has to say.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
How do we find real masculinity with Jesus hanging on a cross? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is titled Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity. It's written by regular guest Pastor Jeff Hemmer. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Men in all stages of life will appreciate Man Up. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Man Up, 1-800-325-3040.
Are you in the Chicagoland area? Do you want to go to a movie? Come see Martin Luther, The Idea That Changed the World, on Thursday, April 27th at the Movie Co. Movie Theater in Rosemont, Illinois. This event is being hosted by St. John's Lutheran Church Chicago, and tickets must be purchased in advance. Go to stjohnchicago.org and click the Martin Luther movie icon on the right. That's stjohnchicago.org to purchase tickets to the movie, Martin Luther, The Idea That Changed the World.
The Reformation's relevancy, natural law, news discernment, modern-day apostles and prophets, depression, catechizing our children. You can meet and hear Issues Etc. regular guests discussing these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
I'm delighted to be chairman of Preach the Word Project, a project of our synod to strengthen the preaching of all of us pastors in the synod. We know how eternally important that is.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Fekencher talking about the new Preach the Word Project.
So we've put together a program of 12 modules that will be coming out this year and over the next 3 years on a variety of preaching topics for pastors to do together with two other pastors, two guys they trust, two guys they feel comfortable with, written materials and very fine video quality materials that are now becoming available.
Preach the Word helps pastors work together to improve their preaching with several resources and by interacting with seminary professors and fellow preachers. Find out more at lcms.org/preachtheword. lcms.org/preachtheword. Preaching is challenging business. We all can use some fresh ideas. lcms.org/preachtheword.